howdy, y'all. And I'm just going to break right into it right now. No more with introductions. It's me, Cam. Over there is barely still alive, Kyle. And we are ready to get back at it. I can't even tell you what has happened over the last couple of weeks.
Man, it has been a roller coaster, to say the least. I know lots of people out there have been asking, like, where has the Elite Show been? I know, folks. I'm sorry. We're slackers. Just a lot has transpired over the last 2 weeks.
Whoa, I almost died. Let's back it up
all the way to the,
to when it started.
The baseball tournament. No, well, let's back it up further than that. When you were out of town, you and your wife went away.
I go out of town last week.
For your anniversary.
And we went up to the Eureka Springs UFO conference up there, the Ozark one. And it was great. We had a great trip. It was great seeing everybody and getting to hang out and talk to everybody and all that stuff. So we had caught everything up until that point. And then Kyle has to go off to this big baseball tournament, which the championship he won. But here was the best thing. What we're going to jump into that is right after that, he had agreed to go on a camping trip with the school to take his boys and chaperone some other boys. And we go out here west of town. And I say west of town, an hour or so out there to the, we've discussed, called Possum Kingdom Lake. So I hadn't spoke to Kyle. Well, and here's what's odd. So was it not this past Wednesday, but Wednesday before was the last time I've laid eyes on this guy till right now. So him and I haven't even, like, we've talked less than 15 minutes in almost, two weeks. Like being broke up from your girlfriend. Like we haven't even, this is the first time we've got to see each other. This fella gets dengue fever while he's out at Possum Kingdom, comes back and is like, dude, that's the sickest you've been in a long time. I don't mean like upper respiratory, folks. I mean like some sort of virus, like can't eat, can't drink, nothing. Like literally, like we may have to take Kyle to the hospital to get like IVs in him because it is not good. I didn't know whether to
wipe my backside or wind my watch. There was fluids coming out of all orifices. It was horrible, folks. So I agreed months ago to chaperone this fifth grade camping trip. You know, I thought I'll be a good dad, and it sounded like a good idea at the time. And as it's approaching, you know, showing up to it, I'm like, yeah, it's going to be a lot of work. It's me and another guy, and then we have a cabin with like 10-year-old boys. Mm-hmm. Well, everything was going good, okay? We did lots of cool expeditions, the canoeing and the hiking up Johnson's Peak and horseback riding.
Hell's Gate.
I'm sure if you follow us on social media, you saw some of that. Everything was going good until, like, the last night we're there. Well, Caleb had already quit exhaustion. He said he had a bad headache and his legs were killing him. I think it's because he probably did more hiking than he's used to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you try to get these 10-year-olds to drink water. Like, look, you need to drink like 7 bottles of water a day. You need at least a gallon of water. You know, you need to stay hydrated. So I think he got too worn out. So he went home early with my wife, but it was still me, the other gentleman that was with me, and the eight or so boys. Well, that's when it hit the fan, folks. One boy wakes up in the middle of the night, throws up all over himself. The other guy, it was his son. So he's like, look, he's sick. I got to get him home. So he gone. So now it's me. I'm alone with like 8 boys under my stewardship. Now it's not that big of a problem. So we go back to bed around 11:30. Another kid wakes up throwing up. Now I don't do well with throwing. I don't like throwing up. And it's one thing if you have.
Is there anybody that does?
I don't know. I'm sure there's. Yeah. What was the guy on the Howard Stern show?
No. Just keep going with your story. Stop.
Okay. So. You know, it's one thing to have to clean up your throw up or your child's throw up, but it's a whole nother to have to clean up someone else's. But I made myself get through it, and so we went back to bed. Well, guess what? 2:30, 3 in the morning, another kid. Now he's throwing up. And when I say throwing up, I mean like all over themselves.
Kyle actually informed me it was much like the Stand By Me part where they were eating the pies.
Yeah. And so if that wasn't bad enough, another kid did again at like 6 a.m. So that last night, I didn't wake up. I didn't get to go to sleep hardly at all. All I was doing was cleaning up vomit. Well, sure enough, when we got home from camp, I started to feel bad. No surprise, right? I had multiple people's vomit on me. I didn't have any cleaning supplies. I didn't have latex gloves. Nothing fancy, folks. It was bad. So then I got sick. And I'm like Cam was saying, I was really sick. I slept. I only stayed awake long enough to take shots of NyQuil and then go right back down. I literally don't remember the last time where I think I slept 21 hours like that. But I'm back now.
It was crazy.
We are going to get back on track, well, rest assured.
And another thing is, I don't even know where to start. We've missed so much to talk to y'all about. Thank you to everyone that sent in their stories and really broke my heart about the whole Plum Island and the Lyme disease. Man. I have had them all sent to me. Mary has got them gathered up and sent them to me, and I have read every one of them, and I will try to get back with y'all, but this is one way of me is thank you all so much. I'm extremely sorry that you have this. It is one of those things I just...
You never know when you pick a subject to discuss on the show, which ones are going to really strike a nerve.
Yeah.
And this was one of them. I mean, we got a lot of people who have experience with Lyme disease, and it's sad, you know, to see so many people dealing with it. And it's also sad that, you know, the government doesn't really seem to want to claim responsibility.
It doesn't seem to be taken seriously enough. And it's just this weekend, too, for me was great because I got to see one of my nieces be wed. But then I had found out, too, this weekend that a dude that I met at my very first disc golf tournament ever a year ago, his name was Matt Mayo. I got to hang out with him about 20 or 30 minutes. He was one of those dudes that you meet and he instantly, you just like, this guy's awesome.
Right.
Yeah. Matt got killed in a car wreck 2 days ago.
Oh, yeah, man.
And I mean, he was like in his 30s, early 30s.
That's horrible.
Dude, he was great. And if any of you guys are disc golfmen, you can go to Jomez on YouTube and you can pull up. You just search Matt Mayo, M-A-Y-O, and you can see him. He's got crazy tie-dyed shirt, long blonde hair. The dude was awesome. Great disc golfer and a great guy. But, yeah, it's one of those things, just like the highs and lows, you know. I mean, the last couple of weeks have been wild with getting ready for that, you being sick, us being in Arkansas where I got to hang out with Stanton Friedman, doing all this stuff, and then now I've got a prom coming up next weekend for my daughter. I mean, this is, I'm ready for everything. We've still not got it settled down.
I know.
We are trying to get it all under control, but our lives are still as chaotic as they were 3 or 4 weeks ago, even more so. So,
yeah. But
we're
going to try to get back on track. So without fail, let's get into the news, Cam.
Well, I've got y'all one.
Yeah.
Now, I have talked a little bit about something like this along the past, and I can't remember if it was exactly this way, but it doesn't sound like it. And the reason I'm touching about this is several of our listeners sent it to me, and Clay was one that emailed me a link to this that come off of Lon's Phantoms and Monsters, because he said, I think it's something you're going to enjoy, and Clay's 100% correct. So I'm going to read this to you. The title is... Little People Are Watching. Now, there's a little disclaimer at the top that I like the way that Lon wrote this in. And he says that it come from Rough River State Park in Kentucky in 2003. Now, he says that there are two sources of this story, and one comes from the ParanormalAbout.com, and then one comes from the Louisville, Kentucky newspaper. Now, he said that he'd found a thread post from a person that states that they actually knew about this event. So he said there were a few details added. Now, I can't remember if I have covered this exact story in the past. It feels familiar, but there's a few more details in here that make it feel not familiar. So that's one of those things. If it's an exact replica, I'm sorry, but this is a hell of a story. Now, this is what happened in June 24th of 2003. It says in mid-afternoon. This is what the witness was talking about. It says that they were on a weekend canoeing trip for rest and relaxation in this remote area of Rough River State Park, and that he was strangely queasy and anxious for some unknown reason, and said that he felt like he had something to fear being there. Said, heeding these sensations, he was extremely cautious on the river. Now, I've had that same feeling when you're kayaking. When I was offshore, even in rougher waters, you kind of get that, like you get those heightened senses, like, ooh, like you, I don't know, it's your body warning you, you know. So the guy goes on writing, says that after several miles, he had paddled the canoe to the riverbank and tied it off on a tree, and he got out just to explore this area. Says, looking downstream about 8 to 10 feet, he had spotted what looked like the top of a gray clay jar just sticking up out of the water. Said his first thoughts was that he might have found a native people's artifact. So he started down the riverbank there toward on the edge of the creek, and he said it was extremely slippery with mud. And he had stopped just short of the water, but very close to this what he calls was an old earthenware pot. Said it was more like a clay crock, and that soon he realized that it probably wasn't very old. Now, he says he poked at it, and he noticed that there were some small handprints on it. Now, he thought it had been because of some raccoons trying to get in there, but he said then he got to noticing they were more like little human handprints about an inch wide.
Mm.
Now, he says he tried to pry this thing loose using a stick, but he suddenly heard a noise. Said he heard what sounded like children laughing in the distance. Now, he said this sound was coming from downstream, and that's when he managed to pull this little crock jar out of the mud. He said right when it came out, something let out a scream. Said it sounded much like a little girl, very high-pitched and loud. Now, not knowing what to do, he grabbed the jar and began to scramble up the muddy bank. Now, glancing back, he said he thought he saw something move along the creek. So he stopped, and he sat up there at the top of the bank for a moment, looking at this jar, trying to figure out these handprints, just wrap his mind around it. And he goes on to add that a few minutes had passed, and he set the crock down, and he got up and walked along the creek, stopping every once in a while to peek through the bushes to see if anyone was there. Now, why he set it down, I don't know, but probably thinking, I'm going to walk down here a little bit, and then I'll just come back and grab it and walk off with it. Now, he says at one point, he looked over the bank, and he noticed two little people standing there. And he said, now, these little people were about a foot tall, folks, 12 inches tall. He says they had very pale skin, little brown leather pants held up by suspenders, no shirts, and little pointy hats made of what looked like leather. He said they had leather foot coverings that went up past the ankle. Their hair was reddish in color, and their eyes were very blue. And he says that their hands were only about an inch wide. Now, they knew he was watching, but they continued their task of pulling some kind of wooden stump down the muddy creek bank with long leather ropes or string. Says these little men were surprisingly clean for the work they were doing. And then he heard a thump back where he had first gone in the creek. He looked back there, and they were three more of these little fellas, exactly like the first two. And that they had pushed the crock jar back down the bank. And they were all laughing, this high-pitched laughter, he said, like a bunch of kids. And he heard a loud snap, and then they were all gone. He said their footprints were plainly visible in the mud, and they were gone along with that crock jar and along with that wooden stump. They had all vanished within a split second. Now, he says he walked around in an attempt to pick up their trail, but he could never find it. Said he got back in the canoe, kept paddling. Nothing else ever happened. So,
man, I would love to see that.
Where do they go? So that still that makes me feel like they're there. We just can't see them, but every now and then, like maybe you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like if there's a. What am I trying to think of? Like if you put up a like a force field around you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go into that force field. What is, there was one of those, was it an old Call of Duty video game? I'm trying to think of one of them that you could pop a force field. May have been like Infinite Warfare. And you couldn't shoot the dude in it. But if you run through the force field, you could fight him inside his own force field.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So I'm wondering if that's, is there something like that? Do they have this force field up? But when you get close enough, you're inside the force field, you can see them.
Yeah.
But when you're outside the force field, you can't see them.
I don't know, but as far as, you know, strange things that we talk about people see on this show all the time, I think the little people would be one I would like to see. Do you? I think it would be neat.
I do, too. I think that's, and I didn't get to a whole bunch of the questions of the listener questions and stuff I had before the trip. I covered some in the videos that I had made, but I think I'll take a bunch of them and recover them. But that's one thing that people are asking, and I'm with you, is I think I still... The little people would probably still be my favorite thing to see. Yeah. And I think just because it feels, like I've said before, so natural. It just feels like in nature, that's where they should be.
Yeah, speaking of things that are seen, this one was just barely seen. Apparently last Sunday at around 2 a.m., now that's American Eastern Standard Time, astronomers at the Stewart Observatory, Catalina Station in Arizona, spotted an asteroid hurtling towards Earth at 106,497 kilometers per hour. It's called the 2018 GE3, and it's estimated to be up to 110 meters in diameter, which is basically the same length as a FIFA soccer field. Now, scientists quickly calculated that it would pass us the following day, but just barely. And they say, actually, that 2018 GE3 would turn out to be the largest known asteroid to ever drift so close to the Earth, and this is the first time it's been back since it was originally spotted back in 1930. And here's the scary part, Cam. They didn't even see this thing till the day of.
Oh, that's not good.
It says the next day it tore past without incident, brushing within 192,000 kilometers of our upper atmosphere. And that may sound like a healthy margin for error, but they say it's not. The moon is only 400,000 kilometers away. So this thing was less than half of that. And so lots of people started asking, you know, what would have happened if it did hit? And they say, well, it's a, you know, they consider it a fun game of comparative speculation. They say that, you know, the Tunguska event that happened back in 1908 in Russia was an object that was only 60 to maybe 190 meters. And this thing is much larger than that. This is 110 meters, they believe, in diameter. Now, they said that that one in Tunguska didn't kill anybody, but that's only because it hit a remote area of Siberia, thankfully. but it did flatten out about 200 kilometers of pines. And if that was to hit a major city, there's no telling what kind of damage. Also, the article brings up about 2013 in Chelyabinsk, the meteor that was captured by all the dash cams on the cars there. They say that thing was only 20 meters in diameter, and it hurt. 1,500 people were injured by that shockwave because of all the broken glass and things like that. So, you know, something much larger, if that was to hit inside of a major city, you know, first off, people might think we're under nuclear attack. Who knows what it could set off, you know, a chain reaction. But this brings up the thing, you know, they talk about it from time to time. NASA claims that it has an asteroid detection program called the Planetary Defense System. And they said that they knew about it. So when this observatory contacted NASA, they're like, oh, yeah, we saw it. It's not going to hit anything. And they're right. It wasn't going to hit anything. But the scary part is this is the closest miss in recorded history. And they didn't know about it till the day before. And when you hear people like Randall Carlson and Graham Hancock and those guys talking about how many times this has happened in our ancient past, and we are a species with amnesia, it seems like, we forget that we are floating in a shooting gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just go around your normal business, just like you were doing. I was violently throwing up at the time this thing passed, I think. You were in Arkansas. But these things happen. And this is very serious, and we need to pay attention. It's not a joke. I mean, how terrifying is that?
To me, it feels like something that's going to happen again.
Here's another thing. I thought about this a lot after I read the article. You know, they're talking about, well, I never heard of this till now. I'm almost glad, because I don't think I want to know. Would you want to know? It's like it's the old thing, you know, if you could go to a palm reader and they could really, truly tell you your future and tell you when you were going to die and how, would you want to know? And I say no.
No, you don't. I don't believe it. There's no way I would want to know, because what builds in your mind when you know you have like a work project due, or you
podcast
know you have
to do.
You have to go to the doctor, or you have to go to. Could you imagine knowing this is the exact date and this is how you're going to die?
No, and I imagine you'd make a lot of deals with God. I mean, I know people. I've done that stuff before. Even though, please, if you just let them hit a home run, I won't ever say that word anymore. You know, you make these deals with God. I'm sure if that hour is approaching, you're trying to make side deals, you know?
Yeah.
So, no, that sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah.
But let's talk about today's show. We're having an awesome guest on. His name is Chris Hegg, and he's an author, he's a researcher, he's an explorer. And this guy's primary focus is on ancient petroglyphs, which I think is very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, he grew up in a tiny remote desert town with only a few people, he said. He said it depends on if somebody died that next day, the population may go down by a quarter. You know what I mean? Like very, very small town, I'm sorry. And Chris said that he spent a lot of his time in the outdoors exploring his surrounding area. And he was actually introduced to these strange rock carvings and petroglyphs by some of the Native Americans there. And he spoke to a Native American herder woman, is what he called her. And when he was little, and she told him tales of the red-headed giants and how she had actually seen three of them when she was a little girl. And, you know, when Chris started hearing stories like that, he was hooked, he says. And, you know, he grew up after time and eventually joined the Air Force. And when he was there, he got involved in cryptology and he learned Morse code. And by learning, you know, cryptology, he went and applied that to these petroglyphs, and he was actually able to decipher some of these. He's been able to, you know, think of it as like emojis, right? These are ancient emojis. And he was able to break them down, and he also noticed that there was the same, you know, petroglyph symbols throughout the world. So it's like it was a universal language among traders, you know. And he believes they're using the rivers and the lake systems to trade goods. And it's a very interesting, he's written a book, and it's called Ancient Universal Language of Man. You can find it on Amazon. I'll put links to it in the show notes and on the website. But we talked with him about several of these petroglyphs, and I find him very interesting. The book is incredible. And so after the break, we're going to get into it. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Folks, we got a special treat for you today. Over the years, we've had several guests on this show, like Rick Osman, Carl Lehrberger, Robert Schock, and other guys that are into this ancient history. And today's we got a really special guest. His name is Chris Hegg, and he's a, I don't know, geologist, rock hound. How would you classify yourself, Chris?
Hello. Yes, I would classify myself as certainly a rock hound, born and bred around a small town that was all some of the original miners in this area, and learned a lot of geology and mining from them. So first and foremost, it's, yeah, I'm a rock licker.
Right, right. And you've written an amazing book called The Ancient Universal Language of Man. And he's a specialist in petroglyphs and deciphering what they are and what they mean. And you've uncovered through your research and studies that they seem to be uniform and universal, almost like it was all a shared language at one point. How did you get started? I mean, you mentioned growing up in a small desert town, but what really got you started into this love for petroglyphs and ancient history? And can you steer us down how you came to where you are now?
Well, it started really as a child. We have a lot of older friends. I had only a couple kids my age in a town of 32 people. Depending on who died that year, we were mostly elderly. But those guys were the historians of the desert. They were, most of them were miners, been around, even driving wagon through with soldiers on horses that were protecting them from Indian raids. Those guys were still alive, and they're the ones that took us, me and my family, around all these ancient sites everywhere. And they just, you know, fascinated me with their stories, not only of what they've seen that wasn't there anymore, like rivers and deltas and stuff that were around old lakes that are just dry lake beds now, but the fascinating petroglyphs and everything, and stories from Indians, you know, going back centuries. We have a local Shurs tribe here, Indian tribe that has a lot of lore. I'm sure everybody's heard of the ancient giants in North America. We have a serpent, a Cecil serpent in Walker Lake that there's a lot of information out there on. Wovoka, who came out of these mountains right above us with the dance that would later be blockaded by the U.S. government because they thought there would be an Indian revolution with it, was the ghost dance. I come out of the same hills and near the same petroglyphs that these guys all took me to. The Fremont, the explorer John C. Fremont came through here. There were Spanish miners. There's just so many layers of the railroad industry and then mining, of course, that I was just submerged in it. And that's that first scary scenario was I wrote in the book, was an old Paiute woman that lived out by a flat called Garfield Flats, lived in a little shack kind of built into a mountain and raised sheep out there. She took us on a trip up to a local petroglyph site that was supposedly where the Paiutes had went to war with the remaining redheaded giants. They were white-skinned, redheaded, and all over 7 foot tall. And the remnants of them actually lived on a floating city on Pyramid Lake, the existing lake that's still here today. And they had killed their king up at this site, supposedly. That was the story from this Paiute woman. And, you know, when you're a young teenager, that will never leave your mind. And so that started my quest of looking at these. And she said that the Paiutes had never wrote petroglyphs, and the original Shurs tribe that had met explorer John C. Fremont by Walker Lake had also told him in 1846 that they didn't do the petroglyphs. It was these giant Seti Ka, they call them, the Tule Eaters, that had done it. And they even captured one time and tortured him to death long ago to try to find out what they said, and could never find out. And they said that their legend was that if someone ever did read the petroglyphs, there would be peace on earth. And that always impressed me. So it always was in my mind that this should be, probably was a language, but of course I was young and pretty localized to central Nevada desert. So it took many years to get outside of the county and start seeing petroglyphs far and in between. And I started tracking how I got here now. I started tracking these petroglyphs through books and everything. Of course, there was no internet or phone, so it was all hard research to try to get, you know, beg, borrow, and steal any books that you could get a hold of to see where these next sites were that I could get to. And as I broadened my search, I realized that a lot of these symbols are the same. And so I started tracking them in earnest. I would start writing them down, drawing in my – I've got tons of research books. You wouldn't believe the amount of drawings I got. I'm left-handed. I'm dyslexic. I've got plenty of characteristics that one good thing is I'm colorblind and I can see textures and shading and stuff really well. And that has always helped me. Even when I went in the service, they took away most of my jobs because I was colorblind, and I ended up being in cryptology, in the cryptology field with doing Morse code and everything. So that training helped me years later, because after all these books and all this compiled research and 110 film, I started with a 110 millimeter camera and advanced to the highly coveted 35 millimeters until recent technology where I had to go back and film every single site that there was. But I would dig through these and I would archive them and try to figure out, is there a language? You know, what are they really saying? Is it all aliens? Is it, you know, what is it? And I could never find anything. It took another, you know, 25, 30 years to finally get the knowledge of cryptology, of how the process works. But the cool thing was I still had all my notes drawn in a kid's format, but they were most helpful because I would sit at the petroglyph and draw these intricate, exactly how they would or I had photos to compare. And that's when I could start going back and really locking it down on what the combination of symbols really were. And then later we moved to Las Vegas, and I got to see the southern region of the U.S. And then after that, I moved back here and to my hometown, and I started working for the government testing munitions, and we started going all over the West Coast doing testing on bases and stuff. And I got to really then see how similar all these petroglyph sites were. And that's where I finally had enough information that I could put together that there all these symbols were the same. And then very slowly came symbol after symbol. I thought, boy, if I can get one symbol, the hardest part was to decide in your own mind, you know, 90% of your brain power is used up. Is it a language or not? Once you can get past that barrier and actually prove that a symbol exists that is universally used, at least in the U.S. at that time, I've since found it's global. But once I found one symbol, that means that language is a language. I can actually say, oh my gosh, that circle right there depicts that's a hunting blind or a sight that's on the ground. And now I can go to all these other sites that I knew of. Of course, that's a return to every single site, because some of these sites I was like, well, wait a minute, there's not a hunting blind over here. I'd go back there. Sure enough, above my head, there exists the exact map that's written in a pictograph on the wall that I show in that book. There exists, you know, if I was a deer, they would have killed me off long ago, because I never knew that those were right above my head. And I've visited these sites 100 times, even camped at these sites. I've hunted at these sites. I mean, and I never knew some of those sites were there until I read the map and went up there, and there's these hunting blinds. So I was like, yes, I've got some real proof here. And then I could purge myself of this, you know, school taught archaeological realm that says that, you know, we were stupid more than 3,000 years ago and just clubbing people 12,000 years ago. And so that's where that all developed.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, through your research, the age of these petroglyphs, are they all from around the same time period? I mean, I know that you mentioned that it's probably 14,000 to 16,000 years ago is when these were made. And not just that they were made, but how intricate they are and how detailed in the amount of work that probably went into something to create these petroglyphs. I think you mentioned in your book that you've done smaller scale versions of some of these carvings yourself to try it out on your own, like 1/20th scale or something. But when you look at the real ones, the amount of work that's gone into it, Were they all from around the same time period, you think?
Yeah, that's a fascinating part, is in the main reason I literally used the word universal language, because it's not. It's that original language was very heavily used in ancient times, but it goes right up to about less than 300 years ago, and then that language kind of became extinct, probably through the wiping out indigenous tribes, you know, throughout the world. But no, there's a site even here close to Walker Lake that's by the train track that has a caboose, and it's in petroglyph language. And there's several train petroglyphs I've been to all around the West Coast that, you know, depict a train. So houses, trains, all white man stuff. So it was used and taught, and, you know, culminated. I don't know if it, I think what happened, it was probably thinned and used more for shamans or witch doctor type things, that where individuals kept that knowledge instead of passing it to everyone. I think at one time it was a very peaceful language because it brought a universal tie that we're kind of going back to now, of course, even with our symbology and our cars and everything. We're an iconic world, and we're becoming more and more iconic. And so you have that. The reason that is to bridge the gap of language, and thus you really become a more social world. And somewhere along the line, I think that was taken into more individuals. If somebody got taught that, they may not have taken somebody on that they could have taught that to. And so these tribes relied maybe more and more on fewer individuals that held that power, because that would become power. And then once, you know, very few got wiped out, that whole entire tribe would lose the ability to know that language. So no, it was used throughout time. I see where Spanish, there's some Spanish sites out here, mines and stuff that they tracked the miners, they killed the miners. It was some pretty brutal stuff on there. And that was, I'm still trying to date that, but that was just several hundred years ago that they used that. And it was definitely Paiutes that did it. And they tell every single fact on there. And so it's very clear that entire language was used and transferred somewhere along the line.
It's reading the book. It's so, this is going to sound crazy, but it's the first thing I thought of reading that book was from the movie Waterworld. And you remember in this movie, if you haven't seen it, but they have their own language. They have their own what's called a trader's language that they only speak on the water. Like, they each have their, you know, kind of like we do now. We all have these different languages in different countries and different areas. But there's a universal language that we kind of attribute to math, or like you're talking about with these icons. It feels like that's what this was. Like, maybe the tribes all spoke different languages, but they also knew that they was if you were like a trader, they was a trader language. And that's what these petroglyphs feel like, is that's how they communicated with everybody. Like, everybody knows this one, but then we have our own language that we speak amongst our tribe. And then that's kind of like what you were even touching on with the shaman, is it feels like maybe not the entire tribe knew it, but there was a group of people that knew it, that was their kind of like their liaisons to the outside world. Because you touch on something that I never thought of, and it's when you start giving a list of the keys to reading these languages, the first thing that got to me was that did you have to understand the physical limits of a man's body and its movement before you understand how these things are written and why they're written. And I was like, that's something that I never even contemplated. How did you dig that, these core of these lists of these things out, before you even started understanding what they meant?
Yeah, that is definitely a great question, because that was the hardest thing to, but my biggest problem with it all was, of course, if you're scientifically going to have something in place, you really, it has to do something, and it has to really mean something that's repeatable. Obviously, you wouldn't have a language of, and that's what I always say, the acid test in there. Once I come up with, okay, this is certainly what it is, then I immediately convert to a disproval situation, where from then on, I am always looking for the one thing that will disprove that I'm correct. And I have done that with many glyphs. And in fact, I've got lists of symbols that are still sitting on that acid list that I cannot prove or disprove at this time, but there's certainly, you know, some are better than others, some disqualified already. I'm looking again for their, I know that maybe that's a close reasoning, but it's not the exact, it's a proximity. But what I came down to was that I thought there would be just one thing, and what could that be? And the only universal language you can find written about was sign language. And when man first came to America, they had found that the correlation of sign language to white people and to the Indian populations, there was something like an 86% correlation between every symbol and its meaning, their actual sign. And so this fascinated me. And so I started delving, this was even again before internet. So I started delving into any books I can pick up that had anything to do with sign language. And I would look at all these signs and I would make motions. I would sit there and draw motions out of the, because they would show you how you hold your positions and then how you would move to the next position to show whatever a word that you're coming up with. Instead of A through Z, I disqualified all them because that would be of speaking only of English. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to disqualify everything except for wording that had to do with maybe nature and stuff, so I can kind of narrow it down instead of a house cat or something. So when I did that, I found a book once that was, I think it was called Shoshone or Cherokee. I think it was a Cherokee sign language book. And it was an old one. It was a reproduction. And it was made by a Cherokee chief that helped originally somebody that made this book actually draw the symbols. So what they would say was they would have a little drawing there that showed the movement, and it would show his hand moving and with an arrow in the direction that his hands would be moving to show, and then it would say the name of what that movement represented. This was an eagle. But then underneath this, this Indian drawer drew everything, and it showed an Indian in every scene of this, or his hands. But if it just showed a hand, it would actually have a jacket on that had tassels on it. Very, very Indian. He didn't want this to be, he wanted it to be representative of the Indians standing there doing the sign language. But underneath, every once in a while, he would draw this symbol. He would put a universal symbol beside it. Like, he knew some of the symbols. It wasn't much, but it got me started in the most basic of forms, saying, wow, why did he put these symbols in? I passed it up for years. I had the book for years before I finally went back to it. And I'm like, I'm going to draw these myself and see if I can come up with some symbols, which I did. A few symbols I actually broke through by my own creation, where I would be like, well, if there's a rain symbol, well, then there must be a fog symbol. Let me see if I can figure that out. And so I would go through everything I could find on fog. I'd have to become an expert on every topic, like you were saying. I didn't know, I wasn't very well informed on how the sun moves in an analemma form, or the moon has a precessional difference too. I didn't know any of that until literally I started tackling each one of those thoughts and ideas, and then that would draw me to a symbol, and then I would go out and actually see if I can prove that this group of symbols out of one of them might be the right one. And I found that sign language was in fact attached to a lot of them, but not all of them. There's definitely a sign language that would be attached, but it appears that some things in the universal language, the ancient universal language, had direct connection only with the physical world and nature. And then some symbology, obviously, because some are based like we use today. We point fingers, and that path of our finger, which I try to show in the book plenty, is the same as you'd see an arrow or an arrowhead on an arrow that we use on a road sign today. I mean, an arrow is an arrow is an arrow. When somebody points, you know what that means. Mm-hmm. Instantly. Your brain is hardwired for a lot of that type of motion in our body. And so that made me realize that there could be two different forms of that language. There's one purely of nature that would have certainly came up with some kind of sign language. And then there's purely sign language that's so simplistic in its meanings, you could not underestimate what that means in the language. You have to use both of those, or the higher function of like nature would be hard to draw. So some are animalistic type figures, like a fox tail being strong. I mean, if you go take on a dog, you look at his tail. If it's cowered between his legs, you might know what that means. If it's straight out, you might run for your life. It's just common sense, mm-hmm. I guess you can say.
It, well, and even there's something else that you had touched on when you're talking about that is and I really, this is one of those deals that I've always thought this. And when you're talking to other people about it, it's something that you throw into the conversation without realizing it. But you had written in there that every carved symbol is exactly what that person wanted it to be because they had to carve it. It's not like we have the ability like we have today where you delete it or you erase it or you just throw that piece of paper away and start over. You, when you're carving in a stone or scratching in a stone, it's deliberate. You know exactly what you're trying to say before you start because there's real work involved in it. So you have to take it for the meaning that is written.
Right. And I forgot that part of that discussion there that, yes, that's one of the most uncanny things and why it's so hard to break the code is because you can draw it in so many ways, but people look at that or archaeologists would look at that, academia would look at that and say, well, that is just a representation of a human form. Well, that representation, every single part of it, if the left arm's bigger than the right arm, if the left knee is bent and the right, I mean, every single thing was exactly how they envisioned it to tell the story. And it all has these extra layers. It's not just talking about a person or something. It's actually talking about, you know, all of the things that happened with that individual, be it a trip or whatever, some kind of war or death or anything. That every single thing is drawn. And that's the hardest thing. So when I realized just how hard it was, like I said, drawing in those small scales, because trying to represent that, even with that artistic ability, just looking at it, drawing it out of the photo, even overlaying the photo and trying to draw it just with a black pen, every fat mark and every skinny mark and all, and then you realize that you missed half of it, half the marks. I mean, there's just so much data compiled into these panels on a single topic grouping that it's unprecedented. I mean, you just literally are blown away. It takes months on a pretty good sized panel to represent it entirely. You do it, then you go back and look, you're like, oh my God, I missed that entire thing in the middle of this. You know, I just went past it because there's so many lines. So you can see the work that they did. Even up close, you'll see pecking and everything. They did the same stylistic as we do as artists today. You spend your time lightly designing it and getting all your forms and perspectives figured out. And this is harder even on a rock face because we can talk later here, I'm sure, on the types of rocks that they put this on. But they chose these rocks and they morphed their symbology to match it. So when you see two stories, two hunting stories on deer sites that are hundreds of miles apart, they're wrote differently. They're not exactly the same. They kind of use the same format, but it's very, very different itself. And those differences are so minute that it's hard to get past the artistic point as it is to start looking at symbols. And then it's so incredibly hard to look at this group of symbols and then start breaking out a symbol. Like literally there could be a man riding a buffalo in the middle of it. And you don't see that symbology maybe for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before you pick it up at the right time or see at the right angle, go, oh my God, now I finally started breaking out the symbols and then things start coming together. Well, those are ones you can read instantly. I've had very few of those, but there have been a few, but yeah.
And I even like how you had shown that they use like even the overhangs and certain ridges on the rocks themselves to help them tell more of the story. So the rock itself tells some of the story. So that's the thing I think that, I mean, really did. We get all these books and we cover all these subjects on this ancient history, and it's our favorite subjects out of everything that we covered. It's our favorite thing. So when we got this and went to going through all this, it was just something that was, I mean, I'm excited now because it changes everything. And I think the more people that find out about it, it's something where people can take your book and use it to go do their own research or their own investigations and get a more idea. It feels, because if you were to take let's say a piece of paper from a language, a dead language now, that or even a language, if you didn't have access, let's say, to the internet or to the library or anything like that, and you were given a sheet of paper with Russian writing on it, and you were like this, and it's just a simple subject or a simple two lines, and you were supposed to figure that out. it would be such a daunting task that if you could only just research slowly, little by little, it would take a long, long time. And I think that we lose grasp on that is when we realize that we have apps on our phone that will do all this, and you have all this Google stuff that will change all the translations, and we realize that what we're talking about now is a very daunting task. Like, they go, oh, well, that's not what it means. Like, we've talked about before that a lot of the academics and a lot of, and I know it's a broad brush to paint when you say they, but at times, sometimes, like you were talking about, you try to find a way to prove that you're wrong when you find this stuff. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. They have their set in their ideas of what they believe the petroglyphs mean, much like the ones in Egypt the same way. They believe that these mean certain things. But what you're finding is this language is something that the universal part, I guess, is what appeals to me the most, is that it's reaching out and touching more and more and more that can help solve some of these questions that we've had whenever people were talking about, well, those rocks are fake, or all that stuff was carved, you know, as a hoax and all this. Well, you're like, well, then if it's carved as a hoax, those people knew the language. You don't just get lucky and understand how to put that together. They understood the language. And I guess when it varies, you know, when it veers from the language, you could understand, well, that makes no sense. It was probably a hoax. Whereas this is like, no, this isn't a legit part of the language.
Right. And that's, I've seen some petroglyphs that where that those modifications have been done somewhere or even added. And of course you can tell with patina and everything too, but yeah, you can look at the, how the context is on certain ones, especially like the spirals and stuff, immediately be able to tell that those were hoaxed out and they didn't know, or they combined stuff. You know, Barry Fell had done research, and there's the one of the researchers that helped him and then later worked for a university to kind of debunk his work for America BC and stuff with this, all these foreign languages and stuff. Her name's Ruth. She drew a book. She was from Gadsden, right over the hill from us, Gabs Valley, one of the founding family that was in that area. And I've talked with her many times, and she was very upset because Barry had used a lot of contrast on those types of shadows and everything to get his way with some of the photographs. And they're even from around here. I mean, I visited almost every single site around here that he's ever photographed. And so she, both sides of it, for him and for the university, and kind of a campaign against him afterwards. And it was interesting because she said, okay, yeah, these things are total BS. And after I'd already researched them too, before I found her, and I said, yeah, I agree with them. And I said, but you know, was there anything that came out of it? And she's like, well, yeah, the problem was the university sent me up to some petroglyphs on the Oregon border that, there was a glacier over them, and the glacier had been there. It had just recently melted off, when she in the 60s had finally kind of wore through, but those petroglyphs, the glacier was there in that valley region where these glyphs were eroded from the glacier, from being underneath this glacier. And those petroglyphs, that glacier is geologically in that area, completely covering that area for 125,000 years. And then she had went, so she's saying that the glyphs are older than even 125,000 years, And she's an actual academic. She's a recovering academic too. Like I keep saying, she's admitted she has a problem, and she's older now. She's retired, so she don't give a dang. But she went to on the same university, went down to the edge of Mexico, and they were doing a dig down there, and Ruth had found evidence of in fact, one of the ladies, I believe, was married to. Trying to think of his name, the famous comet, one of the comet guys that had found one of the recent comets. He'd passed away now, but his wife was also a archaeologist and down there. But they'd found this site. We're excavating a site, and the bones and all the debris and everything there with near Clovis Points was 125,000 years. And that same university would not let her publish either one of those documented cases in there, and the paper is still, of course, sitting in the university, but as far as a peer group, they would not let him do it. So it's interesting how much reality comes to mind just when you think you're really hitting the mark at, you know, 12,000 years old. Here's a archaeologist, a retired archaeologist, saying No, their site's 125,000 years and they won't let us publish them.
Wow.
So that's incredible.
Well, and that, yeah, that is the fact that, because you can't really argue with that it's covered. It's been covered nice. They know for this long. You're like, yeah, that's kind of like it's being sealed in a vault. You can't really argue about that when it recedes and there it is. You're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. I love the fact, too, that you've chased down the seasons. You've got the of course, all the symbols for the seasons. But I think one of my favorite things is how I could get it from the excitement written in the book is when you found the symbol for fire, that it was like, this is something I've been looking for a while.
Yeah, for sure. And fire was one of the, it took that. I figured, you know, again, when I would find one symbol, oh, it would all come to me. You know, it's as easy as the English language. You'd just be able to use some nouns and adjectives and you just have it all together. And not one of those symbols has ever came to me easy. I've had to literally, the only thing that was close and it actually messed me up for another decade and a half was this, the spirals and the season symbols of the concentric rings. Those, because they were together and very close in similarity, a lot of times it took a long time for me to beat enough sites to finally say, whoa, there is obviously a difference here, because I'm finding spirals that are, you know, seven counterclockwise spiral rings. How is that related to, you know, four seasons and so on and so forth? But it's in the same region. So you're like, well, God, it doesn't mean that, you know, we're talking about a volcano or something because I'm talking about the seasons. It has to be something similar because they are always found at the same location and they're always found usually high unless they bracket a whole story and then they're used as brackets. And so that's what finally got me able to break those out and sit there. They took the longest. They took all my life, but finally I had hundreds of sites with spirals designated into their own category files. And that's why I built this book the way I did, is because I wrote a lot more chapters and I pulled all them out. And what I ended up, because what I wanted to do was not only initially describe what the language was kind of as an introduction, but to use it as a field manual, because I didn't want the norm of just saying, well, here's what the symbol means, live with it or don't. What I wanted to do was, here is how the symbol is, here's what I know about the symbol and why it relates to nature, and here's everything that you would be able to go out and say, okay, if this guy's right, then I should be able to go to this panel in South Africa, which would be on the other side of the continent. You got to reverse everything, but I'm over there and I'm going to prove him wrong. I'm going to sit this panel when December comes along and I'm going to say, nope, he's wrong on that. And so I really wanted that field manual type usage in there, not just a book you have to put on the shelf, something you can take with you. And then a lot of, in the end there, a lot of stories, areas that cover a complete panel discussion of what they transferred in knowledge, that everything I knew, which there's still, you know, 100 symbols. It's not an easy language, I would say, because there's a lot of symbology that it probably would break. Every once in a while I find that, you know, 50 symbols may, like the spirals, there's a lot of different spirals, but they all have the same meaning. They just have different differences in that meaning. So they're grouping. And so I thought, boy, you know, am I going to get in that situation where one spiral means one thing, one single, you know, link of a spiral, a 180, but then, you know, seven spirals mean something completely different. But luckily they don't. They all have the same type of meaning. So with the concentric rings, so with the Cassiopeia star system symbol, I mean, they all seem to be coming together in that format. So maybe there's not as many symbols as I think. There might be some groupings. One of them I've been tracking for years, and I'm hot on its heels. And I didn't put it in there because I didn't have all the answers, because there's so many in that grouping. And it's the goods that were moved by this original civilization that did the major petroglyphs inside the western areas where the ancient lakes were. And that goes all the way from Colorado, all the way up to Central Oregon, Utah, all the way through the southern states, all the way to the sea. And those symbols, that's how I was able to break what the meaning, what the reasoning was to have these major sites within the western United States, was that they were the byways, the water byways, and some land connections too, and the areas that where this all these goods were harvested from to the sea, and the flow direction. The reason I've discovered all of that was because this one symbol group is actually all of the goods in a symbol. Like we use a UPC code, so did they. They have a UPC code for every single one of their types of goods. The problem is there is a lot of goods, and trying to locate, they change so much over so many areas. I have to stop in that area and figure out, if I can, what good it is. One of them, the most strangest good that I have spoke with monarch butterfly experts everywhere. There's a harvesting site where they took the larvae, actually the cocoon before you became a butterfly. They would harvest them and take the still liquid interior out, which would be poisonous, and maybe in a quantity it was used for, I don't know, stunning fish or something. We still can't figure it out. I'm going to have to, I guess, like redo that to see how they used it. But they give all the site instructions how to harvest these, exactly when, all the changes that happen within the 7-day time frame that it takes, everything. And so that's just one goods. And just by luck, I had grown up around that area, and I knew that was a migrational stopping point for the monarch butterfly. I would have never known that. And so you can imagine how many goods that they took out of here. That's the what I'm challenged with, and that's why I couldn't put it in the book, is because it might take a whole book in itself to have the ancient UPC codes of all of these all these goods.
I don't know what's more fascinating, the fact that the natives were using monarch butterflies like that, or the fact that you found it scratched onto a rock that they talk about what they did. Because the map that shows all the old ancient waterways, and then you've gone and put the petroglyph sites of where they're all at around these ancient, is mind blowing. Because when you see it, that solidifies the language you're speaking of. Because you're like, all this is trade routes. This is all North American trade routes with all these scattered tribesmen, and that's all it is. They're telling you how, it's road signs. They're telling you how to get there. This is what you got to ask for, folks. This is what's on sale this week. This whole thing is like this. When you made a field manual, and if that's what you claim you were shooting to do, you did it.
Yeah.
Because this thing is, it's overwhelming. The pictures of the stones alone, I can't imagine the first time that you went and sat in front of one and went like, I'm going to figure this out. Because me, I would look at it and be like, man, there's no way in hell. Like,
right?
This is it. I'm done. I'm like, I'm going to go find something else to do, because it is overwhelming, the amount of engravings and carvings. Right.
I'll tell you one funny story. We had a site up in the top of the mountains, and in the center of all of these lakes, if you look at the picture, and by the way, I can find out 7 out of 10 times, I just sit on the couch, and if we're going somewhere, I'll look on Google Earth, and I will implement my same ideas. And 7 out of 10 times, I will have located within a mile or two petroglyph sites in that valley. And sometimes I have contacts all over the place. I will email them and say, hey, if you get a chance, go up there. And they're like, oh, never mind, I've already been there. There's a petroglyph site. You're like a mile off. I'm like, oh, I'll be damned. So I can find sites sitting on Google. And I have since the beginning. A lot of sites I've got listed, I haven't even been to yet. I literally, as I find the elevation data for the lake elevations per valley and everything, I can go then and in that same time frame and put that location in sight. And then I know with good probable cause, at least where one petroglyph site will be in that valley. And of course, maybe two, you know, depending on which side's the valley or if the lake continues, so on and so forth. But it's funny that black market, it's not funny at all. Black market destroys a lot of our sites before we can actually get to them. But they put such a high price on this, and it's only just like going and stealing a road sign off the road. It's nothing without being in place that tells the whole story. So some of these glyph sites were vandalized back in the wagon days. I mean, you know, everybody took a panel and wrote their name on it, you know, ripped off a chunk and took it with them. And I can backlog some of that information now on my sites. I drew in some of my pictures. This should be a spiral of a month. And sometimes I can even give the month. that I'm sure was right there, that what they took, it was a spiral, and so on and so forth. So they're stealing just you know, nothing in terms of it's everything in place and nothing once they don't say remove it for all mankind. But back to my story, I was at a huge site. I mean, thousands of petroglyphs, miles of petroglyphs. And it's up on a mountain. It's in the middle of this, where this empire, or this ancient technologically advanced civilization was running these goods. And been there many times. I've never been able to, even now, I haven't photographed all of the petroglyphs there. And I was like, this is amazing. This is, you know, uncanny. Every single glyph is different. Like, there is no, and there's not big panels. There's some, and then you get into these fields of just nothing. They're just rock with glyphs. And then you turn around after hundreds of feet, and there's more glyphs. And you, it's just thousands of photos I've taken up there. Literally almost 20,000 photos I've taken up there. About a 6 by 2 mile area covered with petroglyphs. So I took my wife. I'm like, hey, I want to go camp up here so I can really spend some time, because this area, just to get to the ends of it now, I have to camp and then hike over to, and it's all just miserable rock that could just break your ankle any minute. So I'm like, let's camp up there. It's beautiful. There's trees, water, and I'll look around and stuff, and you'll love it because there's flowers and everything, and it's real smells really great. So we stayed up there, and they're like, what is this? I'm like, I don't know. You know, I'm trying to decide why it's so huge. And we went to sleep, and about 1 o'clock, we're in the back of my pickup sleeping. And I woke up and I said, oh, I know what this place is. And they're like, what's going on? I'm like, I know what it is. It came to me in my sleep. And she said, what? And I said, it's a graveyard. It's an ancient graveyard, literally with thousands of people. And of course, in the middle of the night, while you're camped in the middle of an ancient graveyard, that is not the thing to tell your wife. And she has not been back camping with me as I go looking for petroglyphs again. But I thought maybe that's something you should know. That if you do take your wives out or something, don't release right. such information.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, how many other people are doing what you're doing, this in-depth with petroglyphs? Is there anybody else doing it? And or what are your, you know, colleagues feel about your deciphering and depicting what these symbols are? Do they agree with you, or is there a lot of pushback?
It depends, but many that I respect highly and have talked with and met through the petroglyph circles, and of course once internet came out, that those petroglyph circles really became social media and websites, and those people that are seriously into it and have that scientific approach to everything, that, you know, they could be wrong, they could be right, and the only way is that proof is they wholeheartedly agree. They love my research, and they ask a lot of questions, and I bounce questions off them. I have no problem, again, with that acid testing, because where I focus is the language. But the people that I talk to, I've got some up in Utah, they'll probably be listening to the show, that are just Mormons, and they just care about those petroglyphs. Of course, that's in their religion, these petroglyphs and Christ on the U.S. soil after the original Bible. So they're very into it, but they only care about the focus, how those petroglyphs relate to Mormonism. And then other ones just look for the Mormon treasure to actually maybe bring back a stronger Mormon church. There's other ones that just look for Bigfoot, other ones just for aliens, other ones just for sound waves. I've got one guy now that he's done a lot. He gets into one research and he goes one direction for years, and then he'll switch and go in other research. And right now he's into sound waves and all these sites. So you got apps on, you can get on your phone now and you could project different sounds, and he records them and checks the volumes of them. And I'm like, hey, I don't got the time for that, so let me know what you find out, man. This is great. And then other ones around the world. I write for Expressions magazine. I don't know if you guys, you should get that for sure. If you don't, Emmanuel has been on many TV shows, and he authors a lot. I've been in several of his books and in the magazines, and it's people from all over the world doing petroglyph research. They from Japan. He'll in these magazines, he'll put out a theme. Hey, this, I want to know about you know, sex in the ancient times and how that relates to petroglyphs. And people write in their sites and their stories about the site, and then he'll put 50, 60, 80 together in this magazine a month. And it's an e-magazine, so you can get it paid or for free, and you could get this in, and you could read everybody's, you know, they'll highlight all the markings and everything. And some people only are doing the site that's right next to their house, and they've thought about that for years, and that's what they write about. I mean, some people are more global, all the way up to the USOX and stuff radio that's been to just every site. I don't even know how they get to them, but they've been to every site around the world. And I've even talked to people that just travel to South America and stuff, and they do tours down there, and they've got so many photos of these other, you know, like the Aztec and Incan empires, petroglyphs and sites that they send me now. And they're like, hey, here's a new site I thought you'd like to see. And I've never seen it on TV. I'm like, why isn't this site on TV? It's these massive stones with all this other writing that, you know, is related. But until you look at these differences in how the original language, which I really focus on, and the newer style languages, like you'd see down south with square symbology. I talk about it in the book. I do 2 and 3D type language, where the universal language advanced and it became more than just stick figures in its basic format. What they did was start giving it shapes and body. So instead of a stick man, you'd have an actual full figured man, and you could give so much more detail and information in just one drawing. It's harder, but then they used, I think they actually miniaturized the universal language by making newer styling instead of rounded, which is very hard to do. I don't know who's tried to do a spiral on a rock, but you should definitely try that. If you think a 7-spiral spiral is something that just says, well, I'm going uphill or there's a whirlwind, has nothing to do with that. Man, you would not do this in your best day, much less in your best month, because it just for on a little rock, it takes me a month to really get that perfect design ground in, not just tapped in. But what they did was square them up. So the same spiral exists down there, but it's in a square format. Everything's square. So concentric rings are now concentric squares inside of each other with a square dot in the center instead of a round. And what that allowed, I think, to do, the language to do, was to be portable. They can, if you look at all the pottery down there, all the stylistics, they all have that same language. And it looks like a Tupperware jar today. If you use that language, which most of it has been eroded, but you could put the whole season month on there. And then when you store goods in that, you can mark right on the pottery the month. And then when you use that, you clean the dish out and you can use that bowl again to seal up more food. And you put the date that you put the food in or that you need to use it up by right on the pottery. And of course it looks beautiful too. So it's artistic on top of that, but it's still a very portable, easy language. Anybody could draw. You don't need that perfect person that can do a perfect circle or a spiral. Anybody can draw a straight line, man. You could use a stick for that. Same language.
Wow. Well, you know, when it comes to the older glyphs, like you'd mentioned, 14 to 16,000 years old or up to 125,000 years, what kind of tools were they using to make these glyphs?
Some of my contacts on there, there was one of them last year that actually found near a remote petroglyph site. I think it was in Arizona or New Mexico. And it actually had this really hard stone that was about the size of your palm, your hand, that went down, and it had a tapered point to it. And it was rounded completely, including the back. And it definitely looked like the pecking tool you could use to do the initial inlays of the petroglyph before you really carved it in with tools that would pretty much wear out. It's hard to find tools at sites. And of course, at that age, you wouldn't really find tools, but to actually find some tool, it looked like a toolkit, a little rock that was rounded, that would tap on this little round. And that's exactly, looking at stonemasons' tools today, it would have been a lot like any of those types of tools. And I think even then, a lot of isotope dating, of course, going back to my geologic experiences and stuff, I'm fascinated always with, like, where did the gold and the copper and the silver come from around the world? And the ones found in the Egyptian tombs and stuff have the isotope. The only isotope that matches is the Carlin Trend here in Nevada. So that mining that I find here too, seems that there was some ancient mining going on. And we're talking before anybody has said any type of metalworking ever existed, there appears to be mining that happened here too, that was some of the trade goods that got moved out of here. Finding that proof though, everything's in a pit. It's hard to distinguish what age it is, but these pits do run ore. There's a actual Stonehenge that's actually close to me. I've been working on the last 10 years trying to figure out this giant Stonehenge, and we actually ran across it accidentally looking at these giant boulders that are out in the valley for ore deposits, and they actually run really high ore. So again, my geologist friend Bart Eckern, the 96 this year, I think he's out there still pounding the ground. He's going to be down this year pounding the ground too. But we'd ran across that taking a break, and he's like, wow, look at all these boulders in one place, because they're usually thousands of feet apart. And then as we're sitting there eating, I was still ignoring him, and he got up on this boulder and he's like, you won't believe this, Chris, but look at this. And he showed me that this is the guy that just doesn't believe in anything. He was like, this is man-made. These things were brought here. Geologically, in the entire valley, no other stones exist in the same place. But these are all in a circle, and here's a keystone we're sitting on. And we're like, what? So we sampled it. They all run ore, and they all have mineable. We did an archaeological dig out there when the local base, that range, was opened up. And they found mammoth bones out there and Clovis points that were 13.5 is what the mammoth bone dates at. And it was in this delta that came in. It was a swamp area. It came into the ancient lake level at that time. And right beside that is this hinge. And right beside that is several ancient mining sites where they at least took the hard siliceous rock and used that for points and stuff. But these mines are so big that these rocks are so hard, you could get it other places. But it appears that they might have actually been mining that stuff too, crushing it down and maybe getting gold out of it. So, again, that's what I'm saying. Some of this proof is right there, you know, beside it, that mining actually took place, and that, you know, gold was and silver was taken out of here, maybe copper.
Right.
Obviously used that long ago.
Hey, Chris, how many different glyphs do you think you've discovered yourself?
Oh man, I've never. I can.
I mean, because when people think about it, you know, for the most part, I think most people in their mind, they think, oh, there's probably like 20 or 30 glyphs that are famous, that are located sporadically throughout the United States. But there's way more than that.
Oh yeah, even within a 50-mile range of me, where my house is, there's 35 petroglyph sites. All wow. Separated. And then you go to those sites and there's hundreds of glyphs, you know, covering 10, 20 areas that are separated, sometimes up to 6-8 miles. So even now, I would say hundreds of glyphs. I've literally, if I go to a petroglyph site, I look at that glyph site and I can tell what type it is, if it's going to be a burial site, like a satellite burial site where it's temporary and it's all used up. But then I can say, well, this is a hunting site, and I'll walk away. Everybody else is looking at these glyphs or something, and I'll head off a mile or so up range, and there it extends. So I'll find my own glyphs, maybe one site that's just a hunting blind, but it's got a glyph there, or a site that has more full panels on it, and those add up to hundreds and hundreds. I found hundreds, you know, 300 or 400 in that scenario. But if you were to combine them, probably at least 100 sites that I found on my own. And even as a site steward with the forestry and BLM work, which is a great program for people to get in, they protect sites, not only petroglyphs, but any archaics 50 years and older, you would go out and actually maintain it. And if there's any damage, you turn it in, or if any fire hazard, there's all kinds of ways for a volunteer to sign up. And we help kind of get this area going. And I'm not in the program anymore, but I still cover the same areas. And if I find any damage, I immediately have all the contacts I can contact right away and get things done. But they always wanted me. I'd show these sites. I'd be like, well, here's one of the sites. And I'd pretty much give the valley. And they're like, where is this? We don't know where this is. We've never seen this before. And I wouldn't tell them because I was too afraid that somehow that information would leak. And this is a pristine site. And I always told them, hey, if there's any damage, then I'll let you know. But there's no use telling you and having this information leak. Here's pictures of it. I'll be back to it. And if I ever see damage, you'll know immediately where the site is. So, yeah, I find sites like that all the time. I can walk in an area, and I don't know if it's because I know where petroglyphs are, I start getting what I call a spider senses. I can start feeling that there are petroglyphs or there are not petroglyphs in that region. We went down to see my son. He's in the Air Force. And we went through Texas, and on the way there, we stopped and stayed in a motel. And in the middle of the night, I'm tired, dead tired. I'm like, man, we got to stop. And so we found this motel, and I crawled into bed, and I'm like, whoa, Dee. That's my wife, Dee. And I said, there's petroglyphs. And she's like, what are you talking about? We're in the middle of a valley. I'm like, I don't care. I'm telling you. She's like, I don't think we're by town, we're by mountains. I'm like, right there. I was pointing right behind my head. I'm like, right up there in the morning. Let's just take a detour, because I could hardly even sleep. I'm like, what in the heck? So when they went right up there, I'm like, I'm going to stop right here. And she's like, it was all cactus. I'm like, I'm just going to pull off the road. I'm going to walk over right over here. And she's like, you're crazy, man. That's going to take you forever. You're going to die of cactus sticking. I'm like, no, I'll make it. I get through there. I come back with all these photos. There was a whole petroglyph site like within 2 miles, exactly where it was. I just have that sense now where some sites are, and they'll bug me until they literally come in my dreams. If I miss a site, I've done that before. Somebody will send me somewhere, and I, in my goodwill, I'm like, nah, I'm gonna do what they say. I'm gonna follow along this ridge. I'm gonna go up here, but I'm feeling the whole time is over on this ridge. It has nothing to do with how they explained it. There sits a glyph, and I won't find them. I'll go home, and the more I stay away from it, the more it like comes to me in my dreams, and I have to go back to that site until I find that glyph. And usually, it's right where I should have initially walked. Just my first instinct gut is to go in that whatever direction when I get out of a vehicle, and usually it's to a cave or a site like that. So
wow, that's incredible, and this book is incredible, and we urge everyone to go out there and get it. It's The Ancient Universal Language of Man. Can you tell people where they can find your book?
Yes, our publisher Roe Publishing has it on her website and Amazon, all the main sites. Even if you're overseas, I see them out there on all of the mainline Barnes and Noble and stuff. So you can get them anywhere. And I did film for possibly for History Channel's Ancient Aliens coming up. And if I make the cut, I'll be on one of these upcoming episodes for my research in petroglyphs.
I'm sure you will. If people want to follow you, do you have a website or a social media page?
Yes. The author Chris Haig. That's chrisheg.com. And that has all my social media links on it and everything.
Oh, man, that's awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. This was a blast. I really enjoy your work. Thank you so much for doing it, sir, and coming on our show.
Well, thank you very much for letting me be on it, you guys.
All right. Take care, Chris. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. That was a great interview with Chris Haig. That's H-E-G-G. I suggest you pick that book up, Ancient Universal Language of Man. Very interesting. He's got lots of photographs of petroglyphs in there. He's got lots of maps.
It's
showing where the... You know, and if you're that type of person or you would like to become involved in that type of thing, he gives you, you know, tips on how to find petroglyphs. Like, he talks about, like, he has an uncanny ability to look at a map, topographical map, or something with Google Earth, and he can spot things on lake systems where he's like, or river systems, I'm sorry, where he'd be like, that looks like an area that would probably have a glyph. And then he can go out there, and sure enough, he can find one.
And you know what, really and truly, like, that's not a real crazy statement to make.
Not if you think about it.
Because, I mean, how many times, look at professional bass fishermen, look at men that hunt. I mean, it's you apply the same thing. You look for certain corridors, whether it be in the lake or be in the woods. You look for, especially when you get on Google Earth. I mean, when I plan a fishing trip or a hunting trip, I go to Google Earth first and foremost and start looking at areas before you even start looking at, now, how do I get access to these areas? Because other than that, it's not even worth your time. So he has that ability because of this whole, it's just a learned thing. But that book is truly a field manual, which is what he wanted to be. I mean, it's one of those things, if you're interested or have it, or even you can read it to learn from, or you can throw it in your pack and take it with you. And it's, first of all, it's something that I want to be able to read and understand just to wow my friends at a party. It's like, oh, I know what that says.
Yeah, you could easily do that. But,
or I could just lie, which is what I normally do now.
You know, and if these were ancient signposts for these traders, I mean, they're going to be in an obvious area. Mm-hmm. They're not going to put a sign hidden somewhere. So it makes sense that he has a really good ability to detect those things. It makes me, you know, I just got back from a camping trip, but it makes me want to do some exploring, because like I was talking to Chris about, is that many times me and Cam have been down the river and we've often talked about it. Like, I wonder what's out there. I wonder how many petroglyphs or runes or something are on, you know, farmers' land that you just don't know about. Heck, the farmer may not even be aware of it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, this guy's busy. He's just trying to plant coastal. He doesn't care.
You don't care what's out there.
He didn't even look at those rocks. Yeah. And there's just things like that out there. And who knows?
And we're going to have him back on. Yeah. Because we had a good discussion off air that we should have probably recorded, and we didn't. And
Do you think I knew it was going there? If I knew it was going there, I totally would have recorded it. Yeah, what we're talking
about. Don't
get
into it. Just give them just the subject. Just tell them exactly what we talked about.
Red-haired giants.
And that's where we're going to leave it until he comes back on.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more to this story that we were none aware of, and it is fascinating. We need to get him back on a couple weeks and have him pick up where he left off on that whole deal.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it was great. But yeah, I'm really glad to be back in studio. I'm glad Kyle's not dead. Well, at least for now. He didn't get any better looking. Like, he didn't lose weight. You'd think he'd get real sick and lose weight. He didn't lose any weight at all.
No, that didn't happen.
So we're going to play catch up this whole week, get everything done up and everything ready and caught up on the elite shows, and get everything trying to get rolling again, because next weekend I've got a prom and Kyle's going to be out of town. You're going to be gone all weekend at a baseball tournament this time, aren't you?
Yeah, we're going to Waco.
Yeah.
And so we will be gone once again all weekend long. But, man, I'm glad to be back. I hope I don't get sick again. I hope it's at least 10 more years before I get sick like that again.
You look terrible still, but I mean, I'm glad you're healthy.
Right? And another thing is, like, when I was at this campsite, you couldn't bring any food or drink in, so I didn't have any fizzy water, any angry water.
No angry water?
No, man. I didn't have any soda pop.
That's why you got sick.
Maybe.
You had no angry water to keep you going.
I was going through withdrawals.
That's what you were DTing.
Yeah, it's possible. Totally
DTing off of angry water.
Oh, it looked like I had drink, you know.
Stop.
Quarter. Stop. A whole bunch of ayahuasca. You hear the stories, right?
Stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've all survived the whole thing. We have all had these trips. So, we're all getting back in our groove. So, we hope y'all are all in y'all's groove. Everything's going good. Everybody, of course, and like I said at the start, thank y'all for sending me the stories on the Lyme disease stuff. Like I said, it kills me. I mean, it's a horrible thing, and I'm very, very sorry for y'all. So, I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea where that's going to go. So we'll just see.
Before we get out of here, I was going to ask about the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference. Yeah. How was your trip? I mean, I saw a lot of the pictures.
It was great.
It looked like it was a good time. I'm sorry that I didn't get to go. Last time we went up there, I got to go along with Micah Hanks, and I kind of missed it this time.
We had a blast. I got to be up there, got to hang out with Nick. I didn't tell Nick that we were going. And so he came up and he was talking to me, and he's like, well, where's Kyle? And he looks at me like, oh, he didn't make it. And it's like Nick didn't trust me. He's looking behind him. He's looking all around. He's looking. I'm like, do you think? And he goes, I don't want him to come up behind me. I'm like, no, Nick, I'm serious. He didn't come this time. But yeah, he didn't believe me. So yeah, we talked to Nick and hung out and talked to Dolan for a while. And like I said, I got to sit and talk to Stanton Friedman, and Stanton's hilarious. And he's going to come on. He agreed 100% to come on the show and discuss stuff. This is last year. When he gets done this year, he's done.
He's done. Out.
Yeah. He's like, I've got to retire. He said, there's plenty more people doing it. And
I get
you
it.
He's old, man. Yeah. Stan's old, and you can just see he's like, I'm just tired of, you know, going through the grind of this. Time to retire and enjoy yourself.
Well, I'm going to say, I'm not going to be doing this when I'm his age. There's no way.
Yeah, you will.
You think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you will.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Well, you won't live to be his age. No. But
what are you talking about, man? I've been drinking all this angry water. It's good for me.
Yeah, it almost killed you getting off of it.
Yeah,
so,
right?
Yeah. So, yeah, we had a great time. Here's what was wild. When we left up there, it was 28 degrees and snow flurries when we rolled out of up there. When I get home, it was 73.
I know, right?
I was like, what the hell happened here?
We have been in some kind of cycle where the weather's beautiful on the weekdays, and every weekend it's nasty.
Yeah.
I know, because I've been sitting in it.
Yeah, I'm not happy about that. I need to get outside. I need to play some disc golf. I need to go kayak. I need to go fish. I need to go do something.
Me and the wife, I know this week we're going to go to the movies. I don't remember the name of the movie. It's some kind of horror movie. The Quiet,
Quiet
Place or something.
Place.
You know, everybody knows it.
I'm going to the
show.
Movies to see Super Troopers 2, baby.
Yeah, I know you said that you tried and it was sold out.
We saw both showings around here was sold out. I may go the minute we get done with this show.
Why not?
I may hit everybody up and see, just see what happens.
There you go. Sounds like a plan.
Right?
Well, I hope everybody out there has a good work week. Don't work too hard. Stay safe. For Big Fizzy and Cam Hale, you've been listening to Expanded Perspectives. Be careful, y'all.
Peace, y'all.